Blog Talk Radio.
And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Good morning and welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. My name is Mark Gillar. Our very special guest today is Star Parker. Star is the president and founder of CURE, which stands for the Center for Urban Renewal and Education. She's also a syndicated columnist as well as a regular commentator on CNN, CNBC, CBN, Fox News, and our friends across the pond at the BBC. That's right. Star is also part of something called the Gang of 13, which sounds very mysterious. I can't wait to find out what that's all about. Star, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you. But you can't ask me about the Gang of 13. That's still a secret.
It's still a secret?
How did you know?
No. Okay.
It's something that Steve Rosen and I are working on. No, you can ask me a little bit, but we are still working underground.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, we can edit that right out if you'd like.
No, it's okay.
Okay, it's a secret, the Gang of 13, but we can't talk about it. All right, now you've teased us.
Just know that there are black patriots in this country. That there are, in fact, there are 800,000 that voted against Barack Obama the first time he ran. So we are gathering them up, this Gang of 13, so that the next time you come Tea Party and in Washington, D.C., you have friends with you, lots and lots of friends of color.
Speaking of African Americans who are patriots, I guess you've heard the news that Anita Moncrief is now forming America's first African American Tea Party in Houston, Texas.
I did hear about that. Yes, I did, and I think what we have to do is show America those that are still listening to the lies of the left, those that would dare to turn on one of the major networks and look at their news and think that they're getting truth. We have to show them that America's for all and that blacks are just as concerned, many in this country are just as concerned about the economic well-being of this country, the moral state of affairs, and all of the rest of the things that the Tea Party brought to the attention of those in power here in Washington. We're concerned about freedom, personal responsibility, limiting the role of government. So I'm very happy that Anita is doing that, and I look forward to working with her as well.
Well, she's only a short distance from me. I'm about 100 miles away, and I've already told her I'd like to attend their next meeting. It's very exciting. I actually have a friend whose wife has started our first local Hispanic conservative group, and I have a feeling between now and November of 2012, we're going to be seeing a lot of people join the Tea Party that will dispel that myth that the Tea Party, and, you know, God bless him, he's no longer with us in the professional sense, but Keith Olbermann likes to say that, you know, it's a group of angry, racist white men, and I think we're going to see a very different-looking Tea Party between now and 2012, thanks to your efforts and the efforts of people like Anita Moncrief, as well as the lady who is forming the Hispanic conservative group. I know there's another Hispanic conservative group forming north of me in Waco, Texas. So let's hope that we can dispel those myths before then.
Well, I believe that that will occur because we can't, as a nation, go on. As most of the Tea Party we're seeing over the last couple of years, the way that we have been. You know, we are at a critical cross point similar to in the 1850s, the way we just can't keep going on, half slave and half free. At a certain point, as Abraham Lincoln said then, you have to converge. You have to be one or the other, all slave or all free. And we've gotten to the point in this country to where we're spending more than we make. We are taking from many to give to a few. This redistribution of wealth, this whole concept of redistribution of wealth is inconsistent with not only Constitution, which many hold dear, but also the Bible, which others hold dear. When you think about covetousness, which is a violation of the 10th commandment to covet, that's where socialism is rooted. It's rooted in covetousness. Somebody has something somebody else doesn't have. So rather than just go and participate in the theft directly, we've allowed the political process to develop to where a politician goes into our neighbor's pocket to pay for things that we should and could pay for ourselves. So we just reached that point to where it was so obvious that millions of Americans spoke up. Not just did they come to Washington and in their local communities to express themselves, but they finally spoke through the electoral process. You know, we battle in the voting booth now, and they went to the booths, they changed that reality, and we hope that, those that are in power here in Washington, D.C., really heard them and are going to do what is necessary. I also hope, of course, that these same American people who are demanding that we live free, that we limit the role of government, that they are really ready to make the hard choices that must occur. You know, when I saw the data recently that only what was under 20% are saying touch Social Security, under 20% are saying touch Medicare, I'm hoping that in our hearts we understand that we've got to make hard choices in these big areas, because these big areas are what are bankrupting the country.
Well, you know, I've paid into Social Security all my life, but I hold out no hopes that it'll be there. And we actually reach a point where the government is only doing the limited things that the Constitution allows the federal government to do. You know, I know I'm personally willing to make those sacrifices, but I definitely get your point. One of the things that I saw in the book was that it seems to me whenever someone tries to help, they almost always end up hurting, whether it's something as simple as minimum wage or, you know, LBJ and his Great Society program and the war on poverty. It seems like everything that's been designed to help has hurt. Is that correct?
Absolutely. You're saying in my Uncle Sam's Plantation book, yes, what I found, and this is the direction all of America was going in, that the Tea Party demanded that we stop. We already bought these ideas in the great 60s when they developed out a great society and declared a war on poverty. There's not one federal program that we can point to now and say we've done anything to touch poverty. A lot of this grew because of the conditions of African Americans in this country, a very poor community that were confronted with not just slavery, but coming out from under Jim Crow laws, a forced segregation, much of that forced by government. So the country then bought into this idea of redistribution. We'll pool our resources and try to bail out this people group. Maybe if we help them with their income, maybe if we help them in housing, maybe if we help them, the list became very long in food, we might lift them out of poverty. Well, we were wrong. Trillions of dollars later, $400 billion we spend annually on just the means-tested poverty programs. It's about $700 billion we spend annually because there's a few that are not means-tested thrown into that. And most people not only can't name one, they can't name one that's working for sure. And in fact, we did nothing to alleviate Black poverty. The poverty rate today is exactly the same as it was in the 60s in Black America. But what we did do through this social engineering was destroy the Black family. That did change because during those wonderful 60s, the Black family maintained an intactness. 78% of husbands were in their homes with their wives raising their children. The family was able to live through slavery, live through segregation, but it could not live through this great welfare state. So today we're looking at 72% of Black children being born outside of marriage and 68% raised in single-headed households. These government programs destroyed Black family life, which destroyed Black community life, because without a healthy family, you're not going to have a place to pass down those values so that people, children, will have a consistent and tight moral framework so that then they can get a quality education so that then they can mainstream their lives and be productive.
Well, one of the things that you pointed out in the book was that this safety net that the government has provided essentially takes away the penalty for bad choices.
We sent out messages through these federal programs that now we're attempting to roll back in Washington, but in the 60s, those federal programs absolutely destroyed incentive. When you think about rewarding ill behavior, the means test of the great welfare society, where don't work, don't save, don't get married. Now, I know this firsthand. I lived in and out of welfare 7 years, 3.5 years consistently, which I talk about in my book, Uncle Sam's Plantation. So for people that say, well, it wasn't exactly like that. We needed to means test so that we made sure that able bodies weren't just taking advantage of the system. No, the message behind that was, if you could not have an able body in the household, this is a means test to qualify for these welfare benefits. They rolled out 10 years later to messages of don't work, don't save, don't get married. So if you're not going to be able to have a husband in the home when the social worker calls on you, then why marry at all? So yes, it did begin to change people's opinions about what their role is in their own lives and what the government's role is in all of our public life. And the next thing you know, there was a dependency. And once you become dependent on any reward, if you will, to sit back, to relax, to think of that somebody else will solve your life's problems for you, you become very, very pathological in that dependency. And that's what we have today. That's why there are generations now of people that are just 100% on government in every area of their life, and they just refuse to look out at freedom from a different perspective. So they keep putting politicians in power that will keep those handouts coming.
I had Daniel Hannan on last week, and Daniel is the British Member of Parliament, member of the European Parliament, who is famous for tearing Gordon Brown apart. And one of the things that he said was, in reference to the situation with black Americans, is that if one particular group of people votes the exact same way in every election, soon both parties take them for granted. Do you agree with that? Is that where black America is now? The Republicans have given up luring them over to their side, and the Democrats say, hey, we got them. So, you know, they're ours.
Well, we see that all the time, and African Americans participate in this. You know, most will ask, well, why is it that they would put all of their political eggs in one basket, in the basket of the Democrats, who it's obvious to many that are freedom lovers, they're taking great advantage of this community. Well, African Americans don't see it that way. They vote, like most people vote, for their economic well-being. So when you have a dependency on government, and I'm not just talking about the black welfare class, the underclass, those that are living in these 4,000 housing projects across this country that are getting benefits according to their estimation and what they're called in the media. I'm talking about the great black middle class. The great black middle class is addicted to government as well because they work for government. The post office just announced the other day that they're going to be shutting down some postal places, mostly because it's a competitive world now. They're competing with the internet. People will rather do that or text message than to send a letter. So they're not getting that revenue source that they used to have, and so there's no need for that business in society. You can believe the Congressional Black Caucus right now are arguing to leave those centers open because this is employment in their communities. Blacks work for the government. 65%, some estimations are showing, work for some form of government, whether it's on a local level, on a county level, and or a state level, and or a federal level. When you think about where government controls, it controls all of our public services, including education. And this has grown black communities' wealth, if you will, when it comes to the middle class and upper middle class. And that's why the largest black communities in terms of wealth and income are right here in Washington, D.C., because they work in those governmental offices. But it did not build a sustainable base. There's no investment. That's why there's no net worth. There's income, but there's no net worth in this community. But so there are reasons that blacks vote Democrat that we do not explore from the Republican and or conservative side because they have lost interest. The Republicans scratch their head, pretend that they're thinking about this community and trying to peel off some votes, but they rather just pray they don't show up. And the same strategy that they're now using with Hispanics. And hopefully, after what happened on the West Coast, starting at Nevada and coming all the way over to the ocean, that we've learned that we cannot just ignore the black community now, the Latino community, because when they do show up, they vote against health for the nation. They vote against freedom and personal responsibility. They vote against limiting the role of government. So these communities who are hit hardest when government dysfunctions, they have to understand that, and they have to begin to participate in the mainstream of America, which means hard work, get a quality education, keep your values and your family intact, learn how to save and invest, and then pass on to the next generation. They have to learn this if this country is going to survive. And so we, as those on the right, must spend time educating this population, because both the black community and the Hispanic community, the Latino community, get their political values from the mainstream media. The polling data shows it very, very clearly. They get their information through the public schools, which are warped in their thinking when it comes to the type of instruction that's going forth. So they hear no voices from our side at all till election day. Some politician might decide when they look at the numbers to go in and knock on a couple of doors in that community and think that they did some great outreach.
You referenced the fact that most people vote to benefit their economic well-being, or as my dad used to say in his folksy way, people are always going to vote their pocketbook. You take, let's go back to African Americans, people that were enslaved for over 300 years and then discriminated against for another 100
years. In this
country,
only 80 years, though.
Okay.
Go ahead.
thanks for the clarification.
Well, we were on that country for 80 years when the Civil War. I hear that from Black. We were enslaved for 300 years. I'm like, honey, everybody was a slave then.
Okay, all right.
Some actually were indentured servants and sold themselves into slavery so that they could get here to this wonderful country that was developing. But anyway, go ahead. So your point
was putting,
yeah.
I was putting on my liberal hat for just a second.
Yeah. Well, I catch liberals in there.
Naturally,
so take it back off.
Naturally, I made an historic mistake the minute I put on the liberal cap. But
your point is that, okay, so Blacks were going through slavery, then through Jim Crow. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you're right. And my thought is that you don't just tell a group of people that have been through all that, okay, you're free, now you've got equal rights, be like us, be like everyone else. People have been held down that long. And I think if you have one side that's saying we're going to keep the steady stream of income coming to you, and another side that's saying, hey, we're not going to give you any special breaks. I mean, I know what I would do. I'm
glad that you're honest about what has occurred. And this is why in African American minds, they say, forget. Think of it as in terms of a relationship, and one of the spouses violates that relationship. And then the other one apologizes, tells you, you know, let's try to fix this thing. But then when you say, well, you know, I really got hurt in that. And then the other, just get over it. You know, we think about great tragedy. And then, you know, someone you may know, and they have great tragedy in their life. And then the next words out of your mouth are, well, you know what? It's over now. Get over it. Well, this is not the response that caring people give to someone that has been hurt. And this community has been hurt. You're absolutely right. That said, though, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., if you read through his speech, the great speech that we all say that we have participated in, the I Have a Dream, he told them, those 250,000 that came to Washington to cash this check, he told them to go back into their communities and build. He actually felt that at that moment, assuming, we were at a pivotal point where they could go back and build. We are going to handle this through law, is what he was saying. So you go back and be prepared to live free. Be prepared to be responsible. Be prepared to get the best education you can for your child. Be prepared to live your life in wholeness, in moral integrity. Well, rather than that, we as a nation had a sexual revolution. We coupled it with a war on poverty. So we began to send out messages that you do not have to be responsible with your life morally and build integrity, especially not in the area of sexuality. We now, instead of natural consequences to be participating in ill sexual activity, we don't have natural consequences anymore. We have safety nets. Within 5 years after King's death, we had Roe v. Wade as national law. So we said, we don't have to think about, as a country, our moral state. We have developed out this grand plan that we can redistribute wealth when you fall on your face. Did you know, Mark, that the top three social crises confronting us as a nation today are rooted in sexual immorality, AIDS, abortion, and the welfare state? So these messages began to come out through our society, and they just hit this community hardest. But yet, there was a participation of the community, so we cannot ignore that as well. I agree with you that the society as a whole, Americans as a whole, have got to be a little bit more compassionate when they look at some of our really hard neighborhoods and they look at some of our people that are beaten down by the legacies of this country. I mean, this was real stuff, and people have to try to live and build through that. Every effort we saw in where Blacks were pulling their resources and trying to put it together were beaten down by walls in society and in communities where they were burned totally down. We can't ignore that on our side. Can we allow this community to continue to use it as an excuse to where it becomes a crutch? Well, no, you don't want that either. We all know friends that do that too. We're 20 years later. They're still talking about the abuse that happened in their household, even though they stayed in that relationship. We know when people have lost somebody very, very close to them, and they just can't get over it. They won't mature beyond it. They won't learn from those mistakes and move on. But there is a point that the greater of society, the mainstream of America, has to say, acknowledge that what we've done over the last 40 years has not worked to alleviate those pains that were upon this one community of people. But we also have to acknowledge that it's a very difficult place for those that the school door was closed to now say, well, figure it out on your own. You can do this on your own. When you look at just the wealth, the net worth, wealth gap, the net worth in this country, the white community net worth per household is around, the average is about $75,000 annually. The black is $7,000. There's no money there. This is one of the problems with working for government. It's one of the problems with working. I mean, you're talking about a community that less than 3% own a business. And of that 3% in the black community that have a business, 80% of them gross less than $100,000 a year. This is a very poor community of people. But what we've conditioned ourselves, especially on the right, to do is just look at the billionaire, Oprah, look at, well, we got a black in the office of the presidency. If we look at as a whole the economic state of this community, we would be concerned, and we would try to come up with strategy to peel away government in their lives very delicately. You know, it's like major surgery here. We're talking about a cancer. You don't go into cancer without going under first, cancer surgery. So we want to delicately do this. And how we can do that is through information, meaning we have to fight for school choice on local levels. We have to rid our country of abortion so that we could stop this hemorrhaging and have people start thinking about their sexuality and participate in their own lives. And then you begin, as you re-educate through a new environment, a private environment, to where we can really discuss hard choices and hard information. That's why I argue for school choice vouchers. Once that begins to occur, we will begin to see the economic realities change to where there won't be that addiction on government, from the great middle class.
That still sounds like a tough transition. I mean, we're all familiar with the saying, you know, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. But there's got to be some transition between giving someone a fish every day and teaching them how to fish. I often feel that as Republicans or as conservatives, what we're saying is, hey, you know that fish a day you've been getting from the Democratic Party? Well, hey, that's going to be gone now. And, hey, good luck with your fishing today.
But it might seem like we're saying that, but that's not true. Like, for instance, when we try to have the discussions on, well, first of all, let's go to welfare reform. Welfare reform, Republican momentum, Republican idea, working on it here in Washington. I was consulting on it way before we even had the 94 sweep, so that once the 94 sweep occurred, we were able then to get that into law by 96. We didn't see children dying like the left said and women thrown to the curb. No, it was just a block grant. So that, and over time, for people to fix their lives. Now, unfortunately, the momentum fell apart with that faith-based initiative. In my opinion, putting the churches on welfare didn't help keep moving that forward. But the Republicans, the opportunity we have now, for instance, to be able to shape legislation that helps fix what's broken down in terms of property, home ownership. The Democrat strategy is, let's just addict them to government, to where now we have 90% of new mortgages addicted to government through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. What does the poor have? They have these housing projects and HUD and $400 billion redistributed through HUD to try to provide a house for somebody that lives on welfare. No, what we can do is incrementally fix it by allowing for vouchers. Let people on Section 8 go anywhere they want to find a place to live. Put some responsibility in the hand of those that are getting the only program that we have that even allows for any choice is the food stamp program. But there's no choice in these other programs. You go when your kid, if you're poor and your kid has to go to school, it's going to the government school. When you are poor and you have nowhere to live, you're going to the government housing. When you are poor and you have nowhere and you're aging, you're going to the government for your economic well-being. So what we have to do is transition. That's why one of the big debates has to be Social Security reform and personal retirement accounts. This is not just good for the nation. to get us off of this government addiction. This is critical for these poor communities, that they have tangible wealth to pass on to the next generation. Right now, the way the Social Security system is designed, you don't own it, you can't transfer it, and you get a horrible rate of return. Well, now for the wealthy, they don't plan to retire off of Social Security. So although it's a nuisance and paying in and then getting trickled back is not something that they want to do, for the middle class, it's one part of their portfolio. So they say, well, you know, I've got a little bit of money accumulated in my home that we can now do this reverse mortgage idea. We've got a little bit of 401k over here. We've got a little bit stashed away in our bank account over here, and we bought some stock. We got a little retirement coming in from our with the company I work for, 28, and I got my little Social Security check. So we have an offset for that little month. But poor people, that's it. They get, as my mom, $700 a month to live off of a government. And every time we say, well, maybe we should have personal retirement accounts, they say, no, that's the stock market. You don't want them to gamble. Well, you know what? The 50 years that she paid into Social Security to then reach that age to where they're giving her a little 70, looking at what the market did over the last 50 years, she would have been better off putting that 2 to 5% into the stock market. And she would have certainly realized more than $700 a month. We just won't have these discussions, and we won't have them based on what they do to the poorest amongst us. This is how the Republican Party should sell ideas of pulling back government when it comes to Medicare, pulling back government when it comes to housing, pulling back government when it comes to retirement savings. Because what President Bush tried to do, and why it collapsed, in my opinion, was said, well, we should base it on youth, on age. Want everybody under 30, maybe we can try to transition them out from under government addiction and having to retire off our Social Security system. The left said, what about that 30-year-old wealthy kid? Look what you're trying to do. This is just, they just want to gamble with your money, and this is a strategy of the wealthy. And we lost momentum. Had he said instead, everybody under $30,000 a year gets to put some of their money into a personal retirement account so that they can begin to build an economic portfolio that they own, that they can transfer to their heirs, that they can start realizing a rate of return over a period of time that will give them a better benefit than they're going to have in the Social Security system, he perhaps could have gotten momentum. Where would he have gotten that momentum? Out of these poor communities, the blacks and the Latinos, because they need that to happen in their lives. They have no wealth accumulating, so they are going to be addicted to government in their senior years if we continue the path that we're on today.
Well, if we have these personally controlled accounts, though, the government can't go in and raid them whenever they want.
Well, you're absolutely, it is nothing but paperwork, and what most Americans don't even understand about Social Security, that the Supreme Court has already ruled twice that it's just a tax, that Congress can change it at any time. Now, we can try to get loud about it and demand that they don't, but they have no choice anymore. We as a country are going downhill very rapidly, and mostly because of these entitlement programs. We as a country now have 10,000 people a day, according to some estimates, turning 65 years old. We cannot go on any longer the way that we've been going. We are at that critical cross point, similar to the 1850s, as I said before, to where we are going to become all government addicted or all free. So these are hard choices that have to be made. You're right. On face level, they seem very hard for poor people. I mean, I was one of the champion voices on welfare reform, and I'm telling you, those 5 million women and 9 million children were scared to death about what Republicans were doing here in Washington based on what they were hearing in the grassroots. I even did the Oprah Winfrey show during that, and she said on her show, these girls are going to be just cut off. They are going to be in the streets. Can you imagine sitting there at your couch as a welfare mom hearing that that's what Republicans were getting ready to do to your life? How scared you must be if you had 3 children and you're in this government housing? And that is not what was occurring at all. Thank God today we have a lot more information resources to be able to get information out, the truth out, about what's really occurring in some of these discussions. But as with cancer and the surgeon, some things are necessary to live. And so even though it might seem like we're hurting this community by peeling back, as you were saying, just not cutting them off, we would never do that as American people. We're too gracious and compassionate. I mean, people give homeless people money on the street, so which postpones just the inevitable. So we are not that people that the left keeps describing. But we are, and back getting to what you were saying earlier about slavery, it's one of the reasons it took so long to get rid of slavery. There were questions about what do we do with these 4 million? Do you just set them free? How? Where are they going to go? How are they going to live? So that's where we are now. But we can ask those questions, but we also have to gently move the people along. You cannot just ask a question and because there's a hard answer, say, well, let's not do it at all. We have to do it. There are too many now dependent on government, and we cannot go on like this as a country.
But it does have to be a gradual transition. Again, I don't think you can just say, okay, hey, we cut off the welfare, and now you get to sink or swim like we did.
Nobody's saying it, and nobody's ever doing it in law. Don't forget, public policy is exactly that, public policy. Public opinion pushes public policy. So, and there is no public opinion that in mass numbers saying cut them off. This is not Republican. Republicans in mass number are not saying, let's just cut it all off. Are you kidding? Republicans are the ones that are saying, let's move into voucher situations. Let's transition them out. Every discussion that we have, whether it's in education, I've been in Washington 25 years now, whether it's in education, whether it's in Social Security, whether it's in Medicaid, whether it's in the welfare programs that we know of that come out of HHS, it's, whether it's housing program, it's always been, let's voucher that program. Let's block grant that program. There's no discussion that says, let's just cut the whole thing off. Now, there are some libertarian thought that in an ideal world, we should not have these programs. I actually agree. Charity is not a function of government. It's not where it should be. It's one of the reasons that it doesn't work. You know, these means tests. Government is supposed to protect our property, not exploit it, which is what these programs are built in, redistribution. But in public policy, you move toward what's best for the person that is on the system, and that what's best for them is to wean off, and that you do through voucher. You allow for them to participate in their own children's education by letting money follow children to whatever school they wanted to go to. You allow for them to participate in their housing by giving them a voucher or letting them go wherever work is. You allow for them to participate in their retirement by allowing them a personal account to where the money that their employer is putting in and sending to the IRS will go into an account with their name on it. All of these ideas are what Republicans are trying to move toward, and they benefit the weakest most. They are the ones that have a greater benefit marginally than the great middle class if we will do these things, weaning ourselves off of this government entitlement mentality.
I can tell you that my parents, without vouchers, scrimped and saved, and we lived as poor as church mice so that my brother and I could attend a very small, very poor Catholic school. And it made such a huge difference.
Absolutely.
In my life and in my brother's life. I mean, the school only went up to eighth grade, but when we got to high school, it's like we were even seniors before we saw anything we hadn't seen through eighth grade at the private school. And when I hear these people talking about being against vouchers, one of their big arguments, and I'd like you to address this, is, okay, fine, then a bunch of people take the vouchers and leave, and the poorest of the poor get stuck in the public schools, which become that much worse because all that money has gone out to the voucher program.
They're lying. The left lies. We have voucher programs in this country, 13 of them, and every one of them serve poor communities, poor people who are wanting more. And they do not then run to white schools in suburbs. People choose local schools. They just choose schools where the men wear collars and have sticks in their hands. That's what the left doesn't like. They don't want these parents taking their children to the Baptist church school or the Catholic school down the street to where they learn that there are absolutes, that government's not God, that actually you have an obligation to your neighbor to be self-sufficient, to be responsible with your choices. We need that. You had loving parents who got you in a school that were teaching you values consistent with those that they ascribe to. What we have today are record numbers of single-headed households that are clueless about morality and values, and kids in these government cesspools. Those kids more need what your parents were able to do for you. And every voucher program we have, and in fact, the one here in D.C. that President Obama stopped, that voucher program that took 5 years of really hard work from some very dear friends of mine here to get a reality to where 1,500 children had $7,500 to go to any school they wanted to go to. That's because the D.C., the politicians in Congress control Washington, D.C., for people that are in Politics 101. Yeah, the D.C. does not have its state legislative body the way you do in the states, to where you can your state house and then your governor participates in how you guys are going to live together in the state. The Congress controls this in Washington. So the Congress decides the schools here in Washington, D.C. Well, the schools were hemorrhaging big time. I mean, they still are, where people won't even send their kids there anymore. So the voucher program came forth about 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, where 1,500 kids were able to take their the parents were able to take their $7,500 and go to any school they want to. I think at that point the schools were spending $13,000 per student on the low end. I mean, if you had any type of special qualification, like, you know, your ADD or your ADHD or all these, your special ed and all this, it can go up to as high as $30,000 per student, and no one was still learning. So they finally brought forth this little voucher program, 1,500 kids, $7,500. The parents took their kids to the religious schools. That's what happens in these communities. That's the only one providing education other than the government in these poor communities are the religious schools. So you have parents that are in these churches on Sunday morning crying to God to help them with their child, who they have to now take to this government school on Monday through Friday, and they're church has a school, but they can't afford to bring their kid there. That's what vouchers do. But anyway, this program in Washington, D.C., you had 1,500 vouchers available. You know how many people applied? 40,000. They had to bring it to a lottery. You know, when Ted Forsman and the late John Walton had a voucher program, they said, you know what, maybe we should try scholarship. This is just to continue the debate of Milton Friedman from 25 years ago, and I think this program was about 10 years ago. They said, maybe we should just do a scholarship program so that we can prove this myth wrong, that, you know, when you get a voucher, white people just run to these private schools so that they won't have to have Johnny sit next to Tyrone. It's a lie. So what they said was, we have to prove it's a lie. So maybe we should put forth a voucher program. So they means tested it. You had to be at the lowest income level, same way D.C. was. You had to be already failing in your government school. You had to have a household that was, you know, just barely making it, and yet you still had 40,000 in D.C. apply. Well, when they had it, they had about 30,000 vouchers available. To where they, and I think the voucher was only like $3,000. It was like, if you have these qualifications, your kid is failing, he's in a failing school, you're in under this income level, all of these pathologies are in your life, you can apply for our voucher. We have 30,000 of them. They got 1.3 million applications.
Wow.
That's how desperate poor people are in this country to get their kids out of these failing government schools. This is not about white people running off to suburban or private educational institutions so they don't have to have their kid sitting with some minority. No, this is about poor people in this country who desperately need a quality education for their child so that their child can move forth in this society, so that they will learn skill sets so that they can be productive adults. Skill sets not just academically, but in morality, because they're in broken households right now, and they're not getting a consistent message of morality anywhere in our public space. Mom's trying in the household. You really want to help people of color and poverty? Then let their kids out of these government schools. Fight in the states for vouchers, only in their neighborhoods if we have to. Let's let them be experimental. They had one little program down there in Florida that the ACLU and the NAACP hated so much. 60 little kids. They took them to court. 60 kids went and got a little voucher to get out of their broken, failing schools, and they took them to court. And the court, they lost. The kids lost because they found in the Florida Constitution a uniformity clause. So they said that violates their educational statutes because the schools, the private schools, are not uniformed. They're not. The Baptists teach a little bit different from the Catholics, who teach a little bit different from the Methodists, who teach a little bit different from the Lutheran in their school. But the one thing they do consistently, uniformly, is they teach those kids how to read, write, and think critically. But it wasn't good enough. And now that case can't get out of Florida because it's in the Florida Constitution. So the people of Florida should fight to get that out of their Constitution so that those poor kids will have a fighting chance. When you really want to get to the point that we say our values will represent these poor communities, and you start fighting as conservatives for things that they really need, personal retirement accounts and Social Security, housing vouchers so they get out of these horrible neighborhoods and communities and go where work is developing, and education for their children, where money follows their children to whatever school the parents want, then we will start seeing ourselves as a community of people grow together and converge our interests. Until that happens, the blacks and the Latinos are going to be addicted to government because the government is the only one providing for them.
By what mechanism did President Obama eliminate that voucher program in D.C.?
Well, education of the D.C. budget is under the jurisdiction of the Congress. So the latest version is that they're just not renewing. What happened was they just got rid of the budget. But the parents cried out loud, and when you have 100 or so black parents at the Department of Education, God forbid if one of the media actually shows the rest of the country this, this black president, so they quietly just allowed for the budget to continue for those that are in the schools already. They were going to yank them out. This is about a year ago. As soon as he got here, he yanked that program. And they were just going to yank them out of those schools and send them back to those deplorable places that they came from. That the government runs, but they said that those kids can finish and graduate from their private schools. They're just not allowing any new children. But that said, what was really interesting about the voucher program here in Washington, D.C. is during that 5 years, the public schools started correcting. See, the lie from the left is, but if you allow vouchers, it's going to collapse the public school. No, actually, the public school had to begin to compete because so many parents were now in this lottery mode that they wanted out of those schools, and they're begging to get on this list, and they're keeping their income low so that they could still qualify. Because if you make more than $30,000, I think it was, then you're not eligible anymore. So it's like, okay, now I'm going to fix. I finally got on welfare. I'm finally working. But if I get to that income level, I'm kicked out to the street. That's what the government does in their education. That's what they do in housing. It's a mess. That's what I tried to explain in Uncle Sam's Plantation. It is a mess what we've allowed to create. And you're right. We have to peel it back. We can't end it overnight because it's too many interests involved. But we have to know about it and begin the peeling back. But anyway, so the public school here in D.C. began to self-correct, and that's where you may have even heard of Michelle Rhee. She became the chancellor and started making some really hard choices. She made the teachers start teaching, and if they didn't, they were penalized. And she began to shut schools that weren't working. And the mayor, black mayor, he was with her, and they were together saying, we're going to fix this educational crisis. Well, the unions certainly didn't want this, because the religious schools aren't union schools, and they never will be. So they're, going to lose some momentum and interest. So they ran a union candidate against the mayor of D.C. in that last election cycle. They sent into the black community, and D.C. is a black town. It is like 65% African American, Washington, D.C. So they poisoned these black communities with that their mayor was a racist, that he had joined the white side. He's, even though he's black, he's a Oriole now, and he's hanging out with people that you shouldn't trust, and on and on and on. So they did elect the union choice this last go-around, and, of course, the first thing that happened was Michelle Rhee, who is now transforming these schools, was looking for new work. And now the kids here will be set back into and settled back into their government cesspools that we call schools.
It seems like anytime anyone on either side is trying to help, trying to create those bridges that bring our communities together, there are elements on both sides that wish to attack them. I mean, I've had C.L. Bryant on this show. I've had Eric Rush on this show. And, you mentioned the term Oreo. It seems like whenever people make the type of efforts that you and CL and Eric are making, terms like, Oreo are thrown out there, terms like House Negro, terms like Uncle Tom. In my case, I'm trying to do an outreach. I want to bring more African Americans into the Tea Party movement. I can recall, having this mindset a long, long time ago. I've personally been called a white N-word, an N-word lover. I mean, it's just amazing how it seems like there are elements on both sides who, the minute people are trying to do the right thing, they're attacked.
Well, that's true. I mean, and people fear nothing more terribly than to take a position that is against prevailing opinion. So we don't say anything. But there are more with us than not. Those are the smaller voices, the hard left and the hard right. They're just loud voices. And for you to be called that, it's very intimidating. And so you might want to back up, which is why even on the left they call the Tea Party racist. Once you say that, that is one of those accusations that shuts dialogue down. The perception of racism now is an industry on its own. Are there racial tendencies and is there racism? Absolutely, but it's not our law today. So what we have to do is rally the law and rally the Constitution. And frankly, in my humble opinion, when the Tea Party, the first time they were accused of racism, you don't get on defense. You ignore. Sticks and stones will break our bones, but names won't hurt us. But what began to happen is the Tea Party then began to go look for people in this community to say, "Would you join? We need to show you off so that so that I won't be called this name because it's not who I am." And now you're in the corner because now that person that you brought to the forefront is now being called. Yeah, well, that's not a real one. And now you got to go look for a real. The interests are different. Blacks have already bought socialism, and how I've explained what happened with the Tea Party and why there weren't a lot more African Americans and Latinos there is because the Tea Party movement was like the fish who didn't know there was water, but now he's beginning to see the sand. He's getting beached, and he's like, wait a minute. They were just decent people in quiet communities trying to live their lives, and government came knocking hard on their door. It wasn't new what government was doing. They just saw it more visibly because it was extreme this time. We didn't get in there overnight, and we're not getting out overnight. And people in the Tea Party need to know that. This stuff has been a long time getting to this point. They just saw it. Well, the Black and Latino community are already on the sand. They've been on a long time. Government has played in their communities for a long, long time to where they will collapse if we unravel government. The Black middle class will absolutely collapse if we begin to say no more. Not just economically in the poor communities, but in our great middle class. Every time we say no federal workers, well, who do you think works here in Washington? And that's the big challenge that we have. We've got to wean these communities off of government addiction. Some you have to do like when somebody's addicted to drugs and rehab just isn't working. They got to go cold turkey. But others, you've got to do the weaning, which is where vouchers come in, vouchers in housing, vouchers in school, vouchers in personal retirement accounts in retirement. We've got to make sure that we get rid of these excess taxes and other wage laws that are hurting these communities. They're keeping business from planting themselves in these harder communities. You know, most often the conservative population looks at the crime rates in these communities and uses that as the major reason business won't come in, which it is a deterrent for business to come in. When you have high crime rates, you don't have a lot of good, healthy family life. And if you don't have good, healthy family life, you're not going to have real good, healthy business life because you're not going to have healthy school life or anything else. But bigger than that are these taxes on these communities. When you think of our cities now, they have so many layers of taxes, nobody can live there except the very wealthy and the very poor. Everybody else just kind of comes in, makes their income, and leaves. And now you have incentive in some areas, like up in St. Louis, to where if you just go on the other side of the line, outside of the city limits, and do your business, you can save major money as a corporation. So we've got to start looking at these things, too. And that's one of the biggest challenges that the African Americans that are a part of the Tea Party have before us, those of us that already understand freedom, is thinking of ways to, number one, get rid of the Congressional Black Caucus. We have to do what you guys did to the rest of the country, sweep them out and get new thinking people in there that care about their community. But we also have to educate these communities on what has broken down. They don't understand how come things cost so much and how come there's no business developing and why their schools can't be fixed. They're told by their leaders that it's racism. That's it. End of discussion. Just keep electing us. But we've got to challenge them that it's not just racism. It's broken family life, because when you have broken family life, you do not have good schools. And if you don't have good schools, you don't have good community. People move where they're going to get good quality education for their children. If you don't have good community, then you don't have business there because nobody's shopping. It works together, and this community has to begin to understand it. The Hispanic community, Latino community is not as bad yet, the numbers. They're right up. They're still under 50% of their households single-headed. You know, where, I mean, children born outside of marriage. The blacks crossed that line a long time ago. So it has broken to the point that we're going to need a Joshua Caleb moment. You know, that wandering in the wilderness is going to continue for a little while. You cannot have more than half of your children raised in single-headed households and going to broken government schools that they teach them moral relativism and secular humanism and think that you are going to have a healthy adult population years down. You cannot have where out of every two pregnancies, one is aborted in that community because you have such unrestrained sexual activity that where, the answer from the left is to give them Gardasil, you know, just start pumping drugs into them. Some things the people have to fix themselves. You have to first acknowledge you have cancer before you can go in and get surgery to get healed. So the black community has a role in this. Public policy can only go so far. But then the community itself has to adopt these policies and then try to work them into their everyday lives.
Do you have time for one more question?
Yeah, sure.
Excellent. The best way to lead is by example. And my take on this book is that it's one of the most brutally honest books I've ever read. You mentioned your experience with abortion, your experience with drug crimes that you committed, and then one day the light bulb came on, and you wanted out of that. Tell us what that moment was for you and how you pulled yourself out.
Well, someone actually turned the light bulb on for me. What happened was I was looking to subsidize my little welfare check because, you know, I told you about the rules, the means test, don't work, don't save, don't get married. So the government couldn't know that you were making some money on the side. So I went to subsidize my little welfare check and ran into some men in a business who frankly looked me in my face and pointed their finger at me and told me my lifestyle was unacceptable to God. And when I heard God, I swallowed hard. I hadn't heard God with a capital G, and I just got out of there. And they kept calling me, want me to go to their church, and I just kept hanging up. And then finally one day I said, yes, okay, I'm going to go to your church so you will leave me alone. I went in their church, and I heard the gospel. I heard that God was in Christ, reconciling the world to himself, that he wasn't counting my sin against me, that he loved me, that he wasn't mad at me, that he came to die for me and redeem me. And I thought, wow, now this is the best news I've heard all my little life. And I was almost 25 years old. So I, when the preacher said, if you want this, you come right down here. I got up. I went right down there. And then I began a process, a journey to adopt a biblical worldview. I began to believe what I read in the Bible. I began to believe what the preacher said was in the Bible after I read it for myself to make sure that he wasn't lying. And I began to make my decisions every day according to those things. And over time, one day he just looked out at the congregation. I guess God thought it was time for me to get off welfare. I'd already gotten off drugs. I'd already gotten myself cleaned up to be pretty responsible in other areas of my life, but I was still on welfare. And that preacher looked out at 4,000 people one day and said, what are you doing living on welfare? And I thought he was talking to me. And he said, God is your source, not the government. And it's one or the other, God or government. And my God will supply your need according to his riches and glory by Christ Jesus. And he was reading it out of the Bible. And I thought about God, creator of heaven and earth, will take care of me. As opposed to this little $430 a month, couple hundred dollars of food stamps and a Medicare card. I got to go to Uncle Sam. I got to hope certain politicians are in office to support me. Maybe I'll go that route. And so I wrote my caseworker and told her, take my name off. And she was not pleased to have one of her little cases leave, even though she always complained about how many cases she had. And then I went out and did what the left says you can't do, and that was get a job. I went out and took what they call menial work. I started answering phones in the basement of a food distribution company. And one day that little white guy who they told me all my life would not hire me because of racism and white people don't hire black people unless government makes them, that little white guy who hired me, came by my desk one day and said, you sure talk a lot. He said, have you ever considered sales and marketing? And he explained to me what that meant. I got a degree in marketing and figured if I could sell for him, I could sell for myself. And I started my own business. And I've been an independent business person since then. Now in nonprofit, I run an organization to try to assess poverty from a conservative perspective and come up with solutions and discuss them with our political class so that we can perhaps get some of these ideas that I've been talking about into law. But I run profit-making business as well.
an absolutely amazing story, Star. I don't know what I expected when I picked up the book. I guess I expected, you know, someone to say, you know, hey, I'm African American and I was poor at one point and, you know, now look at me. And when I got into the level of detail that you provided in this book and I saw the depths to which you had sank and how you pulled yourself out of that, I was just like, wow.
Well, you have to make decisions every day. Everyone has to make decisions every day. And there are things we can do in society to nudge those things to occur. It's what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said. We can't legislate morality, but we can regulate behavior. That's what he was trying to do with the civil rights movement. As you said earlier, you had in the Tea Party people saying disgusting things about transforming ourselves into the country that our founders saw, to where everybody's equal under the law. No, we can't legislate morality. You can't do anything about their opinion. They might die like that. But we can regulate behavior through public policy so that his attitude, whoever that was that said that to you, can't stop me from excelling. And we did that in law. We just have to continue it by allowing money to follow people instead of redistributing $700 billion in these poverty programs to keep them enslaved.
Well, I want to stress one thing. It was not a Tea Partier who said it to me. But as I said before, you get called
probably a liberal. Probably some left-wing liberal speaking what he really believes in his heart, which is why they do nothing but pump abortion, drugs, and ill education into these communities. Probably
A liberal can say anything they want to regarding race and get away with it. I mean, we had Joe Biden say that Barack Obama was America's first clean, good-looking, articulate black man. Harry Reid said Obama doesn't have to have a black accent unless he wants one. You know, Sandra Bernhard said if Sarah Palin went to New York, she'd be raped by Sandra's big black brothers. If you're a liberal, you can make a racist remark. Dan Rather said that Barack Obama couldn't sell watermelons on the side of the road if he had the state troopers to flag down the traffic for him. We've heard nothing but racist comments coming out of the left, and the mainstream media hasn't picked up on any of those. So you do make a good point. A liberal can say whatever they want to, and no matter how racist it might be, there's some excuse made for it. They say they're sorry, it was misinterpreted, it was taken out of context, and the media is like, oh, okay, all right, we get it, it was taken out of context. You know, I don't know what context you could place Obama couldn't sell watermelons on the side of the road if you had the troopers helping him out, that it would make it a good thing, but you know, they get away with that. And
yes,
that's probably a topic for another show, but that really fires me up. I mean, I have probably a hard drive full of racist liberal comments, yet it is the Tea Party that is so often branded as being racist. You've got over a quarter of the people in this country identifying, and I know it sounds like I think I'm the subject of the interview, but you've got a quarter of this country identifying with the Tea Party and a handful of racist signs. And all of a sudden, you know, millions and millions of people are racist. I've not seen a racist sign at one Tea Party, Star. I've seen a lot of signs that say Bush sucked too. And you know, and here we are in the home of the George Bush Library. And
I think they are going to continue that. And I think that the you know, there are a lot of lessons that the Tea Partiers can learn from the civil rights movement, that you just ignore it. You don't answer every accusation because this is their MO. And it won't change. What might start occurring even is they will start showing up at Tea Parties with their vulgar signs on purpose so that they can get a snapshot of that. The answer is now not to go rallying up, even though I'm glad that new works are happening, and you were right in the intro of the show that we have a gang of 13 working on some things for the interest of this country. But if the Tea Party continues to push on our legislators to peel back government, then they're doing the best thing in the world for these poor communities, which are disproportionately black and Latino. So the witness will go before the Tea Partiers to say, we have so much confidence in this concept of America, of freedom and personal responsibility, but you must have a limited role of government, and you must allow markets to flourish, and you must be able to protect your interests with a rule of law and a protection of private property. These ideas benefit disproportionately these communities, not just in this country, but in the world. Look what's happening right now in some of our smaller African nations. They're taking on the ideals of this country, and they're saying, we don't want foreign aid. We want investment and trade. We are tired of the status quo. We're tired of listening to the lies of the left. And they have to be exposed, these lies. As you said, this has been their strategy for a long time because it's built to keep people enslaved. That's what my book is about, Uncle Sam's Plantation. It is a plantation mentality, and they're on top. The left are like the big guy in the house, and the media is like the overseer. And these black leaders, they're like the overseers. They would go out, if one slave escaped, they'd go out, they'd get them, they'd bring them back, they'd make all the other slaves come out and watch them strip the skin off of that one slave so that nobody else will try to run away. That's what we have, their model. That's why they try to distort every single thing that is being done decent and good in this country. What people have to do that are the decent ones and the good ones is ignore them and keep pushing forth goodness and decency.
Now, I know you said in the book you're not a big believer of conspiracy theories, but do you honestly think that the left looks at African Americans and Latinos as one big voting block, and that they know that the welfare system we have in place enslaves those people, and they're okay with that, or are these
absolutely
just a bunch of people
okay with it? They want to expand it. That's what they've been trying to do for the last. Absolutely, they believe they're Marxists. They really believe that they can develop out a utopia. They're like children. They're like three-year-old children who will jump in the swimming pool. Even though you've told them 100 times, you don't know how to swim. You can't do that. And you got to go rescue them. Or they run in the street after a ball. They don't understand. No, they believe this stuff. They've been educated to believe this stuff.
Okay, so it's not a conspiracy. They believe they're doing the right thing for minorities.
Oh, my gosh, they do. They believe that abortion is good. This is their sacrament. You got to have atonement. You got to have these dead babies. They really believe that if these poor and religious communities keep having children, we're going to run out. We're going to run out of supplies. We've got to kill them. We've got to teach them to kill their offspring. They believe this stuff. And you're not going to convince them otherwise, the same way they're not going to convince you otherwise that God is not alive.
So
what we have to do is in the public space, make sure that public policy is driven for peace. And how do you have peace? By removing the government. You have to limit its role so that your sin stops at my front door. You can't have a lawless society. No, they believe it. Are you kidding? That's why we can do all the shouting we want. You're not going to change this man's mind. Well, oh, he's moving to the center. He's not moving one little bit. Not internally. He's like that little kid who said, you told him to go in the corner and sit down. I'm sitting, but I'm standing on the inside. That's what this president is. No, they believe this. And this is a war we're in. And we are at a critical point. It's going to come up on top.
Better watch that language. You
we battle in the voting booth. Oh, no, we don't have to watch this language. No, we are very mature in how we vote and battle these days. We've come a long way, baby, in this country. And for them to try to intimidate, oh, my gosh, you guys are using, you know what? We battle in the voting booth, and the American people spoke very loud in that last election, and we're going to continue to battle in the voting booth. But we are not going to, oh, you know, in fact, I said it on Fox, that's why I said, I guess we all now have to start coming up with 9 and 13-letter words so that we, and replace our 4-letter words and 3, because war is just a 3-letter word. No, I know where we battle. We battle to get public policy. We battle to get judges on courts who understand the Constitution. You know, I've been in this game a long time. And American people have to understand what's at stake. But if they do not have the zeal and passion to want to win, is my point about being in a war, then we will be a country similar to those that have ruins everywhere and say, what happened? That used to be a great society. These people believe what they're pumping. And when they have the reins and robes of power, we saw it. That's what was going on. It wasn't just about the spending. It's their mentality, too. It's how they see the world. They're secular socialists. They don't believe in God. So, therefore, they have to put a heavy, heavy emphasis on government. And that's what we're up against as a nation. And we have to continue to move forth ideas that say, peel back so that truth can come forth. And education is where we have to battle as well to make sure that they stop teaching these doctrines and they teach them in our public schools. And so one of the best things that could have happened to the public schools is the, if I can call it, Tea Party movement of homeschoolers to get their kids out of those cesspools and start building some moral integrity and framework into their children.
We'll start.
And then
we
send
have
the Patrick Henry, and then let those kids come and work here in Washington. And things are changing slowly, but they're changing.
They are indeed, and we are close to running out of time for the Tea Party Power Hour. I want to let everyone who's listening know that they can simply scroll down to the bottom of our website page, where they will see Starr's book, now in paperback, Uncle Sam's Plantation, How Big Government Enslaves America's Poor and What We Can Do About It. All you have to do is click on the link. You will be transported to Amazon.com, where you can get your own copy. I highly, highly recommend it. We've been with Starr for an hour today, but I can tell you we didn't begin to scratch the surface on all the good things in this book. So pick up a copy or go down to your local bookstore and grab one if you can't wait for one to be mailed to you. Starr, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. I enjoyed putting on my liberal cap and getting you fired up a couple of times. It's always fun to do that. You're doing some fantastic work. Keep it up. The best way to lead is to lead by positive example, and your life has certainly been that. The next time you're in Texas, shoot me an email, and I'll come listen to you speak. I haven't had the pleasure of hearing you speak in person yet, and certainly I believe if now you do go around the country speaking. If someone wants to actually bring you to their group to speak, how would they go about finding you?
Just starparker.com, and then just leave a little note there, starparker.com. I'm getting ready to launch a television show, though, so that they can hear me all the time if they want to. I'll be on the NRB network up on DirecTV, hopefully by the spring. But, yeah, starparker.com will give them information about my organization as well as when they can sign up, and then they'll be notified when I'm in their state.
How long before the television show starts?
Well, we're working on all the details now, so I'm hoping that by the spring it will be up.
Starr, once again, thank you for being here today. We enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.